It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. 2020 came to a close last night at 11:59. While 2020 was a rough ride and we might be ready to look forward to hopefully a fresh start in the new year, Central Time wanted to look back at some of the bright spots in the last year and how young people stood up to create change and help others in Wisconsin. Over the next hour, we'll revisit some of our conversations with young people, educators, and activists in the state. Coming up in just a bit, we'll listen back to a conversation with a student who advocated for a statue of Christopher Columbus to be moved from her town into a museum. First, COVID-19 has disrupted our lives in a lot of ways, from how we run errands to whether or not we see friends and family. This is especially true for children who, early in the pandemic, were removed from schools and began learning from home over a computer. But one Wisconsin high school student tried to carve out a fun space online for students to hear a story during the day. When we talked to student Oscar Telshow this spring, he was a senior at Stratford High School. Before the pandemic, he had been reading to pre-K students in the classroom. As schools closed, he shifted his story time to Facebook Live. Here's our conversation. Now, how did you get started reading to kids offline when you first started this? What led you to do that?
So at our school, we have a thing where we can get set up with what we want to do when we're older. So I want to be a teacher. So I was able to get a work experience with the preschool students at the elementary school. So I started going over there every day, and that kind of started everything now.
Yeah. And then schools closed just over a week ago. Everything changed. Why was it important to you to keep this going over on Facebook Live now?
I guess it's kind of one of those things where if they didn't have it, maybe they won't feel normal, but if I keep doing it, make everything feel normal for them. And I guess it just kind of makes sure everybody's on the same page and we all know it's just going to all be all right in the end.
I was looking at the Facebook Live. It looks like you're getting a lot of views. What's the turnout been like so far?
I think the most I have so far is 3,000 or 2,000.
Wow. Some.
But yeah, every day they just keep getting more and more views and people are sharing them and word's getting out about it.
Yeah, I'm guessing you didn't read to 3,000 kids at a time when you're doing it in person.
No. Only about 10 to 12.
Now, what are some of the books you've read so far?
I got all of them on the table still. I'll go read some of the titles here for you.
Sure.
So I read If You Give a Moose a Muffin, The Horse in Harry's Room, There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Shell, Cows Can't Fly, and then today I read I Love You More Than Macaroni and Cheese.
And I understand you don't just do the book. You make time for some extra stuff. What other kinds of things do you include?
This week we're looking to do some baking. Me and my sister are here, so we got free time on our hands, baking supplies, so we're going to do like brownie baking tutorials and things like that.
And there's a joke of the day, right?
Correct. Yeah. Today's joke was, how do you get a squirrel to like you?
I don't know.
You act like a nut.
Do the kids respond on Facebook? Do they send you notes about your joke or about the book or with questions or anything?
Yeah, usually they'll comment on it with answers or whatnot. So those come through as the live's moving.
Now, when you broadcast a book reading, I know copyright can be an issue. How are you reaching out to authors to make sure you can read their stuff?
At this point, a lot of the books I've read have been copyright, so it's just I'm going until they catch me there. But the authors I have reached out to, I just email them, and they tell me absolutely 100% you can read my book. And I just use that as an okay from them to use it, I guess.
If there are authors out there listening and they say, hey, I have a good kid's book, can they get in touch with you and send you a copy or email you a copy?
Yeah, they can reach out on the Helene's Hilltop Orchard page, or they can text me or my mom. I can give my phone number to them if they reach out on Helene's, and then we can get in touch from there.
We're talking to Oscar Telshow, senior at Stratford High School. He hosts Storytime with Oscar weekdays at 11 a.m. on the Facebook page for Helene's Hilltop Orchard. Now, Oscar, this is your senior year in high school, and I know a lot of important things are getting canceled as we move along. How are you doing with this new weird reality?
It's tough. Yeah, being a senior, you really feel like you get a lot taken away from you because of this. But, you know, I FaceTime my friends every day, and we're all pretty bummed about it, especially since, you know, it's our senior year, last sports season here for a lot of us. But, you know, we're just taking it step by step, day by day, being as positive as we can.
And doing this story time, Oscar, does that help you feel like you're doing something worthwhile?
Yeah, it feels like, you know, it's just a sick day for me. You know, I keep saying that, like, you know, maybe these kids are just like, he's still reading to us, and I may not be there with them, but I just think of it, I'm sick today. I'll be at school tomorrow, and I just keep thinking that.
Do you know the age range of kids? I know you were reading to pre-K kids earlier. Do you get a sense that it's mostly 3- and 4-year-olds, or are you getting a variety of kids turning out now?
I've had anywhere from 3-year-olds to 10 to 12-year-olds on here.
Are any of your high school buddies tuning in?
Yeah, I got some of my friends on there. They comment to me back and forth.
Cool. I know a lot of things are on hold right now, but what are your plans after graduation, Oscar?
I plan to attend Ripon College, major in education, and run on the track team there. So,
and what's on the table for story time tomorrow? Do you have a book planned yet?
I'm going to read the other book that one of the authors sent me called Mac Mac the Little Lumberjack.
All right. Well, have fun. Thank you so much, and keep it up, Oscar. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
That was our conversation with former Stratford High School senior Oscar Telshow. He started reading to kids online as the COVID-19 pandemic closed schools this spring. That story was produced by Central Time producer Dean Kinetter in March. Now, this summer, the city council in Columbus, Wisconsin, voted to remove a statue of the town's namesake, Christopher Columbus. The initiative to remove that statue was started by Columbus High School student Abby Adams. She was inspired to get the statue moved to a museum after learning more about the dark history of the explorer. She started a change.org petition and took her case to the city council. Adams talked to former Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson in July.
So why did you feel so strongly about this particular issue?
I mean, I think that I've always kind of cared about it, I guess. I think that When we kind of switched from learning about Columbus in school, from learning that he was a really heroic explorer to somebody who, like, actually, you know, enslaved a lot of people and, like, killed a lot of Native Americans, I think it always really confused me as to why we had that statue up. And I thought that, like, with what's happening, like, right now, especially, like, with racial justice within the United States, I thought that now more than ever, we should be, like, sending that message and taking that statue down.
So you're a high school student, and it can be a little intimidating for someone of any age to take on something quite this big. How did you go from caring about the issue and thinking that something should be done to actually starting the petition on change.org?
I think a lot of it was I had a lot of support when I originally like thought of the idea. I texted a lot of my friends, and a lot of them were like completely on board. They thought what I was doing was great, and Mary Arnold, who's the chair of the Democratic Party, I shared my idea with her, and she supported me as well and thought that my issue was like a very valid thing and would be like something that the community would probably support. And so with all that, I was like, why not? If nobody else does it, nothing's going to happen. So
you started the petition. How did you get word out other than, you know, letting people close to you know, but how else did you let the larger community know what you were doing?
So I went on Facebook, and our city has 2 chatter pages where you can share like what's going on in our community. And I shared basically what I was doing on there. And from that, it spread like wildfire because people have very strong opinions about the issue. And so I think most of our city has probably seen it at this point because of people seeing it on Facebook and then sharing it to everybody. And that was pretty much how it blew up.
You also spoke at a city council meeting. I'm guessing that would be a little nerve-wracking. What was that like?
Oh, gosh. I am not the greatest public speaker. I always have a lot of things that I want to say, but when I get up there, I just freeze up a little bit. So it was a little intimidating, but I knew that everyone on the council was really looking to just listen to me and to be supportive. And I knew that there was a lot of people there that very strongly disliked me, but I think that being able to, like, you know, say my piece, try to say, like, what's wrong about what they were saying and, like, how I have a valid opinion was kind of important. So that was a really good learning experience for me, I think, because I learned how to, like, you know, be able to speak in that sort of setting without, like, being terrified of everybody.
And you also chose your words, I think, very carefully, because you included the phrase, "It was never my intention to erase our history." Why was that an important point to make for you?
I think that a lot of people in our community think that what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say that Christopher Columbus never explored the Americas. He never, like, made a pretty big impact upon our history. And that was not at all what I was trying to do. I think I was trying to explain that Christopher Columbus was not a good person. And I think a lot of members of my community were not taught that. And a lot of people saw me saying, hey, we have new information. He owned slaves. He, like, you know, was not a good person. And they saw that as me trying to rewrite our history and be a social justice warrior and, like, you know, be very, like, PC. And I think that was not my intention at all. I was trying to, like, you know, have that as, like, a discussion or a teaching moment for a lot of people.
We're talking with Abby Adams right now. She's a student at Columbus High School, where she will be a senior in this upcoming school year. She led the petition drive to have a statue of Christopher Columbus taken down in the city. And Abby, you testified in front of the city council, and then there was a vote last week. What happened?
So after a lot of discussion, they finally decided, they voted 4-1 to take the statue down, and I think they're going to decide at a later date where it can, like, have a permanent home with that, like, educational, like, setting where it can have that full historical context.
How did you feel when they took that vote?
I mean, I feel like the city council really listened to us. And I think there was a lot of, people calling for a referendum. And I think that the decision that they made to not go to a referendum was honestly really, really inspiring to see, because they were listening to the people and they were taking action instead of drawing it out into a long process in which nothing would ever be done. And I think especially with all of the controversy and all of, like, the news coverage of this issue, I think that was a really, like, difficult decision for some of them. And I know that a lot of them have a lot of pressure on them now to, like, vote a certain way or, like, do stuff like that. And I think that that was a really good decision on the city council's part.
So you were successful with your petition and your appeal to take down the Columbus statue. It's going to go into storage. You're living in a city named Columbus. You're going to a high school named Columbus High School.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that name being associated with those parts of your community?
I mean, I know for a fact that our city was named after Christopher Columbus. I think it was Ludington and Dickinson who decided that. I don't enjoy living in a city named after him. I think that, you know, maybe one day it'll change, but I think that might be a really difficult thing to go about starting, because there are so many businesses that, like, have that attached to them. And honestly, I think that when you hear the name Columbus when referring to our town, I think it has a different meaning. I think that when we call our city Columbus, I don't think that we're thinking of Christopher Columbus. I think we're thinking of how strong our community is.
And Abby, what advice would you give to other young people who might see things in their towns or cities that they think needs to be changed and want to be part of that change?
I think that, you know, the first step is to, like, do something. And I think I was a little bit intimidated at first, because I honestly didn't think that any members of my community would listen to me or any, like, actual action would be taken. I just thought that, you know, this is the thing that I can do so that I can, like, say that I did it and at least tried. I think you just got to do it.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Abby Adams of Columbus, Wisconsin, talking to former Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about her successful petition to remove her city statue of Christopher Columbus. That interview was produced by Central Time producer Tim Peterson in July. Coming up next, we'll listen back to a conversation with a Menominee educator who received a prestigious National Teaching Award this year. That conversation and more coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. All this hour, we were listening to conversations we had with young people and those who advocate for them from the last year. We just heard two conversations with young people who are working for change in their community. Now we turn our attention to a state educator who's using the Menominee language, culture, and art to promote and preserve tribal history as a pathway for future generations and to positively influence the youth in his community. Ben Greeno is a teacher of traditional Menominee arts at Menominee Indian High School. We talked to him after he won the National Education Association's National Human and Civil Rights Award. Here's our conversation. Well, tell us a little bit about the students and your community there at Menominee Indian High School.
Oh, they're amazing. I guess it's going to be a little bit different this year for us. My students this year are going to be both in school and online, virtual, and we're doing kind of a mixed bag of two days on, 3 days virtual, and we're splitting the community up, and it's going to be interesting. It's going to be hard, and it's new, and but we're a resilient people, and the resilience is built right into the students, and they're going to be able to do well. And I think that that as far as like an education goes, and delivering education to our kids, we're going to be finding new ways to reach them.
And now you are an art teacher, technically, but it sounds like there's a lot of history and culture and archaeology and even math that goes into your work. Could you tell us about what we would learn if we were in Mr. Greeno's class?
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm trying to figure out new ways to reach the kids. One of the ideas comes from a philosophy from the Grand Ronde people in Oregon. They said that we're not raising children, we're raising elders. And I've been thinking a lot about that lately, about how do we instill the values of our elders into our kids in school? How can we help our parents, our grandparents, our aunts, uncles, our community to raise kids that are kind of ambassadors of our culture and really merge with what who we are as Menominee people? So I'm thinking about doing a traditional garden. In my own personal homestead, I've tried that this year, doing it's a ridge and furrow. It's kind of like a raised bed garden. We have them in our Menominee forest that are thousands of years old. And we have this huge agricultural, knowledge, traditional ecological knowledge. And to reconnect our kids with that, using math, using science, using our history, and getting them out and being active and social distancing and, providing something that's going to build community, strengthen our community, and give back to our community. I think those are the things that that our people are looking for in our kids.
And you've also used some Menominee arts and crafts as part of your curriculum. What kind of things have you worked with your students on over the years?
Oh, I've been working on this project, looking at Menominee beaded belts, and looking at the geometry that's included in there. So, we do a design program on the iPad. It's just a real simple, using an Apple Pencil and filling in dots, but also talking about Pythagorean theorem and area and reflections over a line and trying to bridge some of the knowledge that they're learning here in the high school with our traditional understanding of geometry. It's really fascinating. And then they get to actually, do the beadwork and think about that and make those designs so that maybe they'll remember some of those formulas that they need for such an ACT or something like that.
Well, you've had, as I mentioned, statewide recognition. What was it like to learn that you'd received this national award for human and civil rights from the National Education Association?
It was overwhelming. It's really nice to be recognized, and I felt really humbled, and I thought that it's going to be a great opportunity to showcase my students and showcase our community, and I guess bring a little bit of attention to the things that we're doing, the things that we're working on through education and through community building.
Now it sounds like you have more than a full-time job already. I understand you're also working on your doctorate in First Nation Studies at UW Green Bay. Can you talk a little bit about how that fits into your goals and your hopes as an educator?
Yeah, it's really opening my eyes. I've been kind of a lifelong student, and it's taken me many, many years, and I have many, many credits built up because I have this yearn for learning new things, a yearning for that. And I want to instill that in my students and to show them that that our education can be something that that builds who they are and builds their character, and can give back to our community. And I'm learning a lot of things through our First Nations education program at UWGB about respect and responsibility and reciprocity and relationships. They call it the four R's. And I'm going to be building that into our curriculum for this year and thinking about what the standards are of education, especially in a traditional arts program, which is, I don't know if there are any other traditional arts programs in the state of Wisconsin. So it's kind of a lonely enterprise, but it's really cool because I get to build it the way I think that build upon it, the way that I think that our elders would appreciate and respectful to who we are as Menominee people.
Ben, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you so much. Wawanin.
That was Ben Greeno. He's a teacher of traditional Menominee arts at Menominee Indian High School. We talked to him after he won the National Education Association's National Human and Civil Rights Award. That conversation was put together by former executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson in August. Coming up after the news, we'll continue our amazing Young People special with a conversation about students seeking racial justice in their communities and how one local advocate is working to make lives better for young Black girls. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. All this hour, we've been revisiting conversations with young people, educators, and activists who work to make Wisconsin a better place in 2020. Coming up in just a bit, we'll hear a conversation with a Madison-based advocate who's working to create a community that's more supportive for young Black girls. Now, this summer, a pair of recent high school graduates in Appleton decided to spend their summer organizing for racial justice in their city. The two young people began Appleton Community Catalyst following the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. His killing spurred protests across the country and calls for more accountability for police and a greater push for racial justice. Here's WPR host Keely Boltina speaking with Endemazia Fonkum and Isabella Devine about the goals for their group.
So, Isabella, tell us about this organization you started. What is it? What are your goals?
Sure. So Endemazia and I started this organization. Both of us recently graduated from Appleton North High School. And after the killing of George Floyd and all of the protests and things that were happening in Appleton, we really wanted to create an organization that would continue the movement in different ways. Because just because the protests were ending and people stopped posting things on social media doesn't mean that the problem stops. So we created Appleton Community Catalyst basically to combat racism within our community, let people know that there is racism within Appleton. It's not just a New York problem. It's not just a Chicago problem. It's happening everywhere. And that we really want to give minorities a voice within our community and highlight their stories.
And Endemazia, where do you see the problems then that Isabella is highlighting?
Yeah, so like Isabella was saying, racism isn't just a New York issue. It's everywhere, but it's also in everything. So that's kind of what spurred the inspiration for our first event, which was a free food bank in our downtown area. Because our downtown area is one of the less affluent areas in Appleton, but it also is a food desert, meaning that there's no access to a grocery store in a 2-mile radius. And so when we're looking at low socioeconomic areas and seeing that overlap with racial diversity in our area, we thought, well, let's go, let's get started, let's give people what they need. They need food, they need housing. These are all areas that racism has seeped into, especially in our area, where it's less interpersonal and it's more systematic.
How did that free farmers market work out?
Great. Honestly, beautifully. We had over 1,000 pieces of produce, and just, it was really, really beautiful to see our community come and give, even though it was a day to where we had an extreme storm and we got rained out. But it was entirely youth-led as well. So I got to see so many people, almost 20 volunteers, come together, spur of the moment, when we're thinking that there's about to be a tornado sweeping our way and we're just trying to get people food, pack up all the stuff, load it into their cars, take it into a garage, and then personally deliver it to families at their doorsteps rather than having them come to us. Hmm. So it wasn't what we expected to happen, but it was not better. But it was more heartwarming.
Isabella, did you see people make the connections you were hoping they did, that it wasn't just about hunger, but it was about race, it was about connection and community?
Yeah, I did. So we did a lot of social media work before the Free Farmers Market so that people knew what our mission was and why we were doing it. But a lot of people started to acknowledge the fact that we do have an issue in Appleton. And that it's not going away anytime soon if we don't do something about it. And so I think that people open their eyes to what's happening in our community. And that's why so many people came out and gave us and delivered food for those lower income families.
Yeah, Isabella, though, I mean, you acknowledge you're both 2020 grads. What motivated you to go in this direction and start something like this as you graduate from high school?
Yeah, so Endemazi and I both have experienced racism for our entire lives. It's something that, being a person of color, that's just, sadly, it's what comes with the description. And so it's something that I think both of us have been thinking about for a long time. What can I do to share my story and have people understand what it's like to be Black in Appleton? And I called, or Endemazi and I got on a call one night, and we hashed out the entire organization in one night, just because we had so much passion for making a change within our community. That didn't necessarily see us for who we were. And again, a lot of it was, the reason it all started going was because of the killing of George Floyd and the protests and the posts from people our age on their social media accounts. And we started to worry about what happens when that stops. Do people forget about the movement? And we know that just because the protests are stopping doesn't mean that there isn't still an issue.
Yeah, and thinking about that momentum, though, I mean, graduating from high school is one of those times in our lives where we like have an opportunity to cut ties, right? Like, you could just walk away. You could just say, yeah, Appleton has its problems, but I'm not going to be there anymore. And instead, Endemazia, you're trying to make connections and tackle these issues in your hometown.
Yeah, that's something that we've been thinking about, because we kind of started with this knowing that our involvement in it kind of has like an expiration date. But if we don't start it, then what's going to happen? It's better for us to take that momentum and push it forward and then leave a sort of legacy for others to pick up and like pass the torch onto other people who can take that momentum and move it forward and move it towards change. Because the fact of the matter is that if nobody does something, then nothing gets done. And we'd rather start something and have it keep moving forward than lose the momentum in the first place, even when we're both looking at leaving in about a month.
Yeah, and to add on to that, there are little children who are children of color who are experiencing the same things. And so since Endomazi and I both went through that, we'd like to change it for them. So the future is them, it's us. But to have, if you can make enough change where a five-year-old doesn't have to experience racism the way that I did when I was five, then you're making a change, and it's a positive change, because no kid should feel othered at such a young age or ever.
Isabella, how did you feel othered then? How do you feel othered?
It's very interesting, not in a good way, obviously. But definitely at school, you walk into a room and you're constantly aware of how many people of color are in the room with you. And you're reading texts that have to do with African Americans and people, and some of the books use the N-word and things like that. And people look at you as if you know everything and should be able to give them the answer of whether or not they should say the N-word or be an expert on slavery or that type of thing. And it becomes isolating, or people use the N-word as a joke all the time. It's kind of like a tagline, unfortunately. And so I think for a lot of minorities, they feel isolated in the sense that they always feel slightly different than their white counterparts.
And Demazia, are you trying to tell your story, trying to make connections with local leaders so that the community can try to tackle some of these issues?
Yeah, of course. Going through our Free Farmers Market event, we had a lot of cooperation through the city of Appleton, through our new mayor, and we also had a lot of support coming in from local business leaders and other people in city government. It's really, again, heartwarming to see that kind of support coming from people who are so prominent in the community, and seeing even like the city of Appleton has a diversity coordinator come out so strongly in support of an initiative like this. It's a connection that we hope doesn't just end with an event or two. And we believe that there's a strong commitment going forward, but that's what a lot of our other projects try to address, is saying it's not just a protest and it's not just a farmer's market. These are things that we have to constantly challenge within ourselves and make sure that we're creating a better world going forward.
And Demazia, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Isabella, thanks for being with us.
Of course.
That was Endomazia Fonkem and Isabella Devine, two 2020 graduates of Appleton North High School. They joined us on Central Time to talk about their racial justice organization, Appleton Community Catalyst. They talked to WPR host Keely Boltina. This interview was put together by Central Time producer Tim Peterson in July. Coming up, we'll revisit a conversation with Laleda G of Madison's Defending Black Girlhood. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're revisiting conversations we had with young people in Wisconsin and those who advocate on their behalf. In November, we spoke with Laleda G. She made it her mission to be a voice and advocate for Black girls and women who've experienced sexual abuse and trauma. After writing a book about her own experiences of sexual abuse and healing called I Can't Live Like This Anymore, G founded Defending Black Girlhood, a Madison-based nonprofit that welcomes Black women to join her in her life's work to defend Black girlhood by creating safe places for Black girls to heal. Here's Laleda G speaking with former Central Time executive producer Judith Sears Poisson.
Can you talk about what you thought was missing in the world that inspired you to create the organization Defending Black Girlhood?
The defense of Black girls has been missing. You know, in 1962, the Honorable Malcolm X had a profound comment that the most disrespected person in America was the Black woman. And though I agree with that, I go deeper to say if the Black woman is disrespected, then so is the Black girl. And the Black girl has a lot less power to do anything about it.
And is it that issue of power that that made you name the podcast, the organization, Defending Black Girlhood? Is that the element why you believe Black girls and women need that extra protection?
That's part of it. But the other part is that I want people to understand what we need to do, and what we are about doing is defending. Like, we are in that action, and we need others to join us in that action, so that it, people understand that it is something that an action must be taken in order to do it, not just happy thoughts, not just good wishes.
What do you think is not understood about the challenges and the threats that Black girls and women face?
I think it's less of an understanding and more of apathy. I think what we don't have is the heart that goes towards Black girls who become Black women and carry the scars from their girlhood as well as historical trauma with them. And so I think our hearts are not turned to Black girls. You know, when we look at the estimated 65,000 Black girls and women who are missing right now, and that's only on reported numbers, you know, that's larger than most towns and cities in the state of Wisconsin. And there's not an alarm. You know, when one white girl goes missing, the world stops. There's 65,000 missing, and we're just going on. And so I think the issues that are impacting our Black girls, we have to turn our hearts towards them.
Talk a little bit more about that, Lalita, that not only is that obviously a tragedy and a travesty for those 65,000 missing Black girls and women, but what message, as you were just saying about how a white girl in danger is treated versus a Black girl, what message does that send to other Black girls and women?
It shows that the message is that you're not valuable, that you're not important. Not only can one of you go missing, but 60 plus thousand of you can go missing, and the world goes on. And I think that we have to understand that if we have a crisis of Black girls, that impacts all of us, that the value that they bring to schools, to families, to communities, that when they're gone, it matters. And when we don't even go looking for them, when we don't ring the alarm bell, then it just gives them the message, it doesn't even matter that you were here, and it doesn't matter that you're not any longer.
That actually was the topic of the first season of the podcast, which is also called Defending Black Girlhood. And it focused on those missing Black women and girls. You've now started the next season. What are your plans for this next installment?
Great question. Yeah, the first season was very intense when we took the whole season to talk about Erica Hill, who was a Black girl who was missing from our Madison community for 12 years, and the police were never called to look for her. And so we went very in depth with that. This second season, we're going to be hitting a number of topics, talking with local women, national women, about issues that impact defending Black girlhood. And so the season started off with another young Black girl from our community, Aprina Paul, who was missing, and subsequently we discovered that she was murdered. We had an in-depth conversation with her mother.
And you also spent time talking to Alice LaRue in this new season, who lost her daughter in 2013 and has now made it her mission to talk about and bring to the surface sex trafficking. Let's take a listen to her talking about her experience.
I was angry for a long time. Then I let that anger go and forgave her. Mm-hmm. And I told her, I forgive you. That's when I started seeing her.
Wow.
I can remember the first time when I said, I forgive you. I'm sorry. I just had this talk because I had to let it go. I was making myself sick holding all this anger in. Yeah. You know, it wasn't doing me no good doing it. So once I did forgive her, I can remember the first time she came to me. I was sitting on the side of my bed, and I'm a dream, of course.
Yeah.
And she's at the window, and she said, Mom, I'm sorry. Can I come in?
Oh, my God.
And she came in. We talked, and she said, I'll be back. That's when I woke up.
Very, very powerful there,
wow.
Lalita. Why is it so important for you to take these stories to greater, very raw emotional depths like that?
I need people to feel the pain of Black girls. I need people to feel the pain of Black women and understand it, be touched by it, because I think as much as we try to deal with social justice and racism in our country, to me, the core is having love. And I think when we can feel each other's pain, then we can't help but respond in some kind of way. And I think it's also important for us to tell our story, for us to have voice. And I think that's having voice is as important as being heard.
We're talking with Lalaita G right now. She's the founder of Defending Black Girlhood. It's a Madison-based nonprofit organization that inspires Black women to join her in her life's work to defend Black girlhood. She also hosts a podcast of the same name. And Lalaita, your podcast and the organization Center on Healing. What are some of the ways in which you see healing taking place and that you really want to advocate for and help support?
Absolutely. And so one of the things that I have come to deeply understand in my work is that when Black women don't heal, Black girls are left undefended. And so as we help Black women to heal, to deal with their personal trauma, to deal with their historical trauma, they are in better positions to be able to themselves defend their Black girls, to also advocate for their Black girls in the school system, the social services within the community. And so that healing is so much at the core. And sometimes it means that we are working to heal the Black girl within Black women who never got a chance to heal.
It is incredibly difficult to talk about trauma and to bring those experiences to the surface, to share them with other people. In your experience, Lalaita, how do you talk about trauma and what are the rewards in getting past that hurdle?
Yes. And so trauma is tricky because it's like the pulling off of the bandage, right? And so when we begin to enter into conversations, I've led countless groups of girls, of women, over the past 30 years, and everyone is kind of suspect and afraid and ashamed as we begin to have these healing conversations. But as we begin to share, and as we share the hidden parts of our lives, and then somebody else says, yes, that happened to me, or I understand that, suddenly you are no longer in the darkness by yourself. When you've gone through a traumatic experience, when you've gone through an abusive experience, usually that darkness stays between you and the person who victimized you. When you begin to heal and have these conversations and have this bridges of community with other women, what ends up happening is you are no longer in that darkness with that person. Light comes in. And when the light comes in, you're able to alleviate a lot of the shame that you have. And so that's this part of it's like, first is having the courage, and it takes an extreme amount of courage to heal, to begin a healing journey. But once you do, you find out you're not alone and there's others that can walk with you through this journey.
Lalaita, before we let you go, I'd like to ask you, how can other people, regardless of gender, race, background, experience, promote this kind of healing and really support and recognize the work of Black woman-led efforts like this?
Absolutely. One, we have to know that we need to believe Black women and hear Black women, that we know what's best for ourselves and for our girls and our families. And then the second thing is seeing what role do we play, because we are either promoting defense of Black girls or we're hindering it. There's no in between.
Lalaita, thank you so much for joining us and thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Lalaita G. She's the founder of the Madison-based nonprofit organization Defending Black Girlhood. She spoke with former Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson. This conversation was put together by Central Time producer Natalie Guyette in November. Last week, I told you about a Christmas song that had been written and performed for dogs, with lots of friendly voices and high-pitched sounds that dogs love. But you might be thinking, yeah, Rob, music for pets is all well and good, but how about some music by pets? Happy to help out. If you spend some time online, you may have seen a lot of videos of dogs and cats interacting with musical instruments, mainly pianos and other keyboards, like dogs pressing down keys on an organ or cats batting at piano keys. That's cool, one at a time. But what if someone got a band together? On the Twitter feed of a band called Good Will Smith, they did just that. They put together four viral videos: a cat playing a piano, a cat leaning on a keyboard, a dog batting at a keyboard, and three kittens playing with two turntables but no microphone. Y'all ready for this? It's the music of the future today. Might be a little out there, even for me, but the kittens on the turntables are very adorable. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
If only I could have a puppet, I'd call myself so very lucky just to have some company.